streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Today is Friday, September 21st. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Morgan Yee. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:04 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We also have our science segment, Simply Science, with Sarah Chow, as well as an interview conducted by our very own Morgan Yee with the member of Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club and Phil Chang right here on News 101, your source for independent news.
And now for your UBC campus and local headlines. Westbrook Village, part of South Campus, is getting a new community center. This project comes as part of a plan to expand the village capacity over the next 15 years. There are expected to be more than 6,000 households in the area, with 9 more high-rise buildings in the works. The 30,000-square-foot center is intended to accommodate this growth. Construction is slated to start this winter. The new center is slated to have a gym, general meeting and multipurpose rooms, along with a dance studio and cafe space. Charles Menzies, a resident since 1996, said, quote, "It's the Manhattanizing of this campus. They have 9 high-rise buildings planned and several that are already here. They're basically somewhere around 40% increase on campus population, and that's going to put a big strain on the campus population insofar as space," end quote. A soccer complex is also planned for the area, with one large field and 2 smaller ones. Construction begins this fall for those. The plan for the community center was developed by a working group involving the University Neighborhood Association, UBC Properties Trust, and the associated professional teams working on the development. Walter Frankel Architecture and Karen Keist Landscape Architects. Currently, the old barn community center is only 8,500 square foot, not including the cafe. Construction on the new center is scheduled for January 14th, 2014. The soccer field should be usable by late spring of this year.
Today in UBC history, lumberman Leon Kerner and his wife Taya donated $1 million to fund education, charity, and culture in British Columbia. This is in 1955. At this time, it was the biggest private donation in BC history and set up the province's third private foundation, the Leon and Taya Kerner Foundation. Now, 57 years later, the organization remains one of the province's most active foundations, giving out grants of $5,000 to $25,000 to, quote, "stimulate and invigorate nonprofit organizations in the cultural and creative arts and the social sciences," end quote. Students in the fine and performing arts can also receive grants of $5,000 to $10,000. The foundation has dispensed more than $9 million in grants over the years. Leon said when he made the donation that, quote, "this is the grandest country in the world and we felt we owed it a great deal," end quote. Taya died in 1959 and Leon in 1972, but their generosity lives on in the foundation and the Taya Kerner House Graduate Center at the University of British Columbia.
On Wednesday, the University of British Columbia officially opened the new Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences building, a state-of-the-art learning and research facility that will allow UBC to graduate 224 new pharmacists per year by 2015, a 40% increase and provide more than twice the research space for drug discovery and healthcare innovation. UBC President Stephen Toop said, quote, "The new pharmaceutical sciences building is a remarkable achievement and redefines the future of pharmacy education and practice in the province," end quote. A $133 million, 246,000 square foot building also supports the expansions of master's, doctoral, and doctor of pharmacy programs and offers a new home to several other research organizations, including the Center for Drug Research and Development. $86.4 million of the money for the project came from the UBC. Apologies for that. We're having some mechanical issues. $86.4 million of the money for the project came from the BC government. John Yap, BC Minister of Advanced Education, Innovation and Technology, said, quote, "Our government is committed to providing the students with the education they need to succeed. This facility will ensure that the BC has the pharmacists it needs to help meet the healthcare of British Columbians now and for the future," end quote. The new building is intended to also increase the community atmosphere of the program by introducing the story of medicines, a permanent interactive exhibit that tells the story of pharmacy through hands-on touchscreen technology, games, historical pharmacy artifacts, and will help visitors better understand the pharmacy profession, the development of drugs, and how they interact with the body. There is also a proposed pharmacy clinic which will allow students and practitioners around the province to get valuable experience working with patients. Supervised by licensed pharmacists, students will provide medication counseling to members of the public.
The University of British Columbia has partnered with the U.S.-based Coursera company to provide upper-level, non-credit courses free of charge to anyone with internet access. Starting spring 2013, UBC will pilot three non-credit courses taught by renowned UBC faculty and researchers through Coursera's online learning platform. Coursera was founded in 2011 by two Stanford University professors to transform teaching and learning through massive open online courses, and in partnership with other universities, serves 1.3 million students from 196 countries. The platform hosts more than 200 courses across a broad range of disciplines. Simon Peacock, Dean of the Faculty of Science at UBC, said, quote, "Our partnership with Coursera will enable us to reach people around the world and to evaluate an exciting new teaching and learning technology. Ultimately, I believe all UBC students will benefit from our exploration of this rapidly evolving online space," end quote. UBC's Coursera offerings are Useful Genetics with Professor Rosie Redfield, Computer Science Problem Design with Professor Gregor Kixalis, and Climate Literacy, Navigating Climate Conservations with Sarah Birch and Tom-Pierre Frappé-Sene-Klaus, instructors for the UBC Continuing Studies Center for Sustainability. Coursera courses typically consist of videos or voiceover PowerPoint presentations with student-led discussion forums, interactive activities, quizzes, and assignments set at regular intervals.
A nonprofit representing Vancouver sex workers has been cleared by the Supreme Court to challenge Canada's prostitution laws, as the court has dismissed an appeal by the federal government that tried to stop this challenge. The ruling means that Downtown Eastside Sex Workers United Against Violence Society can go back to BC Supreme Court to pursue a case it launched 5 years ago. The suit takes aim at a broad range of provisions in Canada's anti-prostitution law, including bans on keeping a bawdy house, that's B-A-W-D-Y, living off the avails of prostitution, and communicating in a public space for the purposes of prostitution. At stake in the Supreme Court's decision was the broader question of whether an advocacy group or a person not directly related to a case can be given standing in a constitutional challenge, as the records show that no sex workers have individually come forward with a challenge. Lawyer Katrina Pacey with the Pivot Legal Society say they're not sure yet on how or when to continue the legal challenge, but they plan to see how a similar case in Ontario plays out. The decision comes in the wake of a similar case in Ontario, where a court there struck down the ban on brothels last spring. Former sex trade worker Cheryl Kisselbach, who joined the case with public interest standing, said, quote, "I am thrilled that I will have the opportunity to proceed with the case and that my basic right to access the courts has been recognized. I have the safety and support to do this now, and it would have been impossible for me while I was actively involved in sex work," end quote.
Vancouver City Council has voted unanimously to start working on what could become a ban on the sale and trade of shark fin products in much of Metro Vancouver. Councillor Carrie Jang said Tuesday that Vancouver's decision to work with Burnaby and Richmond on a shark fin sale and trade ban is a major move in saving sharks from extinction, and city staff have already begun informal discussions with these municipalities. Anti-animal cruelty groups say more than 70 million sharks are killed each year through the practice of finning, which involves cutting off shark fins and tossing the sharks back into the water to die. Despite the fact that shark fin is a traditional delicacy in Chinese-Canadian cuisine, councillors have said that the fight against shark fin sales is not a swipe against Asian cultures, but is a drive to prevent extinction of a species.
And those are UBC campus and local headlines here on News 101. We are going to take a... Actually, we are not. We are now going to Morgan Yee's interview with the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup. And here's what they had to say.
Jill, thank you for being with us today. We just have a couple questions about the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup.
Great.
Like, what are you guys doing?
Well, this is our 19th annual Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup. It happens every third week in September. And what we do is, all across the country, we encourage people to get out and clean up their local shoreline.
Cool. So is this, like, how many communities do you work with?
Well, we have, the program began back in 1994 here at the Vancouver Aquarium, and it grew from there and is now a nationwide event that we have cleanups happening in every province and territory.
So that would include lake shoreline?
That's right. When we say shoreline, it's anywhere land meets water. So it can be a lake, a river, a stream, or the ocean.
Very cool. How do you substantiate what you're accomplishing? Do you guys have a collection of all of the, like, all the debris?
Well, we do ask our participants to collect data on what they're removing and then send that in to us. And what that allows us to do is tally up the data nationwide and then also by province. Then we can get an idea of exactly where the majority of this litter is originating. And what we find year after year is that the majority of litter actually originates from recreational activities. People actually, it's land-based, so it's people visiting their shorelines and, you know, either accidentally not disposing of their garbage properly or
right.
Not disposing of it in the way that they should.
Now, are you expecting to find more tsunami debris? Because I know last year in the news there was a lot of things like people finding motorcycles washed up on shore. Are you expecting to still be finding that sort of thing?
Well, we're not really sure what we'll be finding as far as the tsunami debris. I mean, that would only be for sites along the west coast of Canada.
Right.
That tsunami debris would actually be washing ashore. And so it'll be really interesting to hear from those site coordinators on those areas of what exactly they're picking up. The thing to keep in mind about the tsunami debris is that it's often really hard to determine where the debris originated.
Okay.
Because on those, you know, on the west coast of Canada, things wash up from other countries all the time. And the other thing to keep in mind about the tsunami debris is that the amount of the debris that actually went into the ocean as a result of the Japanese tsunami is really a fraction of what goes into the ocean every year.
Now, like, if there's listeners who want to get involved, do they still have time to sign up?
There is still time. Cleanup week does run until the 23rd, so just a few more days left.
Okay.
So, you know, if someone's super motivated and they still want to get a cleanup together, there's still time to do that. Or there's lots of opportunity to join a cleanup that's already being organized by someone else. And all of that information can be found at our website at shorelinecleanup.ca.
Well, perfect. Thank you very much for your time here.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for your interest in the program.
Yeah, and thank you for the great stuff you guys have been doing, keeping our shorelines clean.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Jill. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And Morgan, once again, that was a member of the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup who will be cleaning up our beautiful shores over the weekend. And Morgan, who is that once again?
That was Judy from the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup.
Right on. And
nailed it.
Of course. News 101 will interview a couple of volunteers from that event
on
Monday. So please do tune in for that. And now we have, we're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us on News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. We are going to have our local weather forecast as well as Simply Science with Sarah Chow right after this.
Shindig is back. CITR's annual Battle of the Bands spans 13 weeks and 27 bands. Past participants of Shindig include the Pack AD, 3 Inches of Blood, Japan Droids, You Say Party, and so much more. The second night of Shindig takes place September 18th at the Railway Club starting at 9 p.m. featuring Nomadics, Sean Stibbards, and Teapot Hill. For all the details, search CITR Shindig on Facebook or go to citr.ca.
Hey, what's wrong?
I've been looking for a job since I came to Canada, and I haven't found anything.
Have you tried WorkLearn?
What's WorkLearn?
Part-time jobs on campus for international undergraduate students just like us help me find a great job that's actually related to my studies.
Wow! I'll have to check that out.
You should. It's good pay, good experience, and good for your career. Just look for WorkLearn postings at www.careersonline.ubc.ca. You can even ask your profs and campus staff if they can create a job for you.
To participate in WorkLearn, you must be an international student seeking an undergraduate degree in a participating faculty and registered full-time, with a study permit valid for at least 6 months. For more information, visit www.careers.ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. I am Chirag Mahajan, and up next we have Phil Chang from UBC Stomp Club to give us our weekend weather update. Hi, Phil.
Hi, CJ. Thank you. Hi, listeners. If you were to head over to the English Bay right now and gaze out westwards toward over the waters, you'll be looking at the air mass which will be over us this weekend. Now, air masses are colorless, but if you visualize air columns present under those large lumps of gray clouds and imagine them supporting them, well, these air columns are all composed of what we called maritime polar air mass, called MP for short. This type of air is notorious for producing fog, drizzle, clouds, and light but long-lasting rain when it comes into land. Fortunately, our models are not predicting precipitation over the next 3 days, but definitely expect extended periods of cloudiness over this weekend. So up next now, the official weather summary for the next 3 days of Environment Canada. Today, cloudy, a mix of sun and cloud this afternoon. High of 18, UV index of 3 or moderate. Tonight, partly cloudy, low of 13. Saturday, cloudy, high of 18. And Sunday, cloudy, low of 13, high of 19. So that sums it up. Have a weekend, listeners, and please join us again on Monday. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club.
Thank you, Phil. I'm looking forward to Sunday, where things get sunny again. Oh, wait, it was cloudy. Never mind. All right, so that was our weekend weather forecast. And it is now time for your provincial and national headlines.
The British Columbian Green Party has announced that University of Victoria climate scientist Andrew Weaver will be running for the Greens in the Victoria constituency of Oak Bay, Gordon Head. Weaver, as a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was one of the recipients of the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. Quote, "We're very excited, and I think that this is significant for the Green Party and for British Columbia politics. We now have a caliber of candidate people who want to... We have a caliber of candidate people want to vote for," end quote, said Party President Jane Stirk. Who went on to tell reporters that she believes recruiting Weaver will help attract another 4 or 5 high-profile candidates and that the party hopes to elect enough MLAs in the May 2013 provincial election to gain official party status. In their announcement, the party quoted Weaver a frequent speaker at environmental rallies, in stating that with a rudderless provincial government and the potential for a landslide NDP victory in the upcoming election, I felt now was the time to get engaged and ensure that the principles of economic, social, and environmental sustainability will continue to be raised and discussed in the Legislative Assembly. End quote. Weaver's last foray into elected politics came in the form of his 2001 bid to join the Board of Victoria School District 61, a race he won with 7,201 votes, placing him 15th out of 19 candidates, according to the November 18th, 2002 Victoria Times Colonist newspaper.
On Monday, we reported that the Canadian Food Inspection Agency ordered a recall of ground beef products sold across Canada at Costco, Walmart, Safeway, and Kalahoo meat stores. This recall was ordered after tests that were conducted in the U.S. came back positive for E. coli. Agency spokesman Garfield Balsam confirmed that word of the positive findings came from the Food Safety Inspection Service of the U.S. Drug Authority on September 3rd, nearly 2 weeks before the CFIA began issuing advisories on ground beef products produced at Edmonton-based XL Foods. The CFIA issued produced at Alberta-based beef factory. The CFIA issued yet another expansion to a recall of ground beef products made by Edmonton-based XL Foods on Friday, extending an advisory whose scope has now grown almost daily since it was first issued on September 16th. The unbranded meat products carried at Walmart locations in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and British Columbia have officially been recalled, according to the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. The other products included in the expanded advisory were sold at Metro locations in Ontario and Safeway stores in all five provinces. For more information, the complete list of affected stores and products can be found on the Food Inspection Agency's website at www.inspection.gc.ca.
The tuition increase that triggered such social strife in Quebec was cancelled Thursday during an action-packed first full day in the office for the Parti Québécois government. The new government repealed the fee hike by decree in its first cabinet meeting less than 24 hours after coming to power. Premier Pauline Marois has acted on a promise that she had made during the election campaign. She announced the decision at a news conference after the cabinet meeting. Marois said tuition will go back to $2,168, the lowest in Canada. With the planned increases, it would have been $600 higher this year and would have kept growing each year. Marois said she will not decrease funding for universities and will make good on a promise to hold a summit on how to fund universities within her first 100 days as premier. The government policy entering that meeting will be to suggest indexing future fee increases to the rate of inflation. That would raise tuition by a rate of around 1 to 3% most years, compared with the 84% increase over 7 years planned by the previous Charest government. However, university fees have remained frozen in Quebec for most of the last 40 years.
Ontario's top court ruled Friday that two men should not be extradited to the United States to face drug charges because of their Aboriginal status. In the ruling, the appeal court said, quote, it would be contrary to the principles of fundamental justice to send the men to the United States where their heritage would not be factored into sentencing, end quote, the way it is in Canada. Factors under what is known as the Gladue principle are considered in Canadian law to try to offset systemic discrimination against Aboriginal people. The Justice Minister didn't properly take these factors into account when he ordered Zachary Leonard and Rajon Jeannette extradited, and for that he was wrong. The Leonard, a young member of the Rainy River First Nations with no criminal record, was arrested at a U.S. border crossing in 2006 when the van in which he was a passenger was found to be carrying 46,000 ecstasy pills. If he is prosecuted in the United States, he could face 19 years in prison. The court said, given his age, lack of a record, peripheral alleged involvement in the crime, his Aboriginal status, and steps he has taken to rehabilitate himself since then, he might not receive any jail time in Canada.
The diplomat who the African nation of Eritrea said Friday that his government would continue collecting what some call an extortion tax in Canada, even though the Department of Foreign Affairs has demanded that it stop. The one-party state lacks a formal economy and has been demanding 2% of the income from Eritrean Canadians, as well as payment of a national defense levy. The RCMP reports that those who aren't paying are facing intimidation and threats such as reprisals against family members still in Eritrea or blocking of activities by the consulate. Last week, Canada sent a diplomatic note to Eritrea warning that the consul's accreditation would only be renewed if Ottawa were to receive written assurance that the tax scheme had stopped. Eritrea responded in a letter on Tuesday that it would comply. However, the Eritrean consulate has since confirmed that while the taxes will no longer be taken in at the consulate, Eritreans in Canada would still have to pay up. Eritrean consulate Semer Mikael said, quote, "I am not going to collect the tax in my office. That's all. That's what the Canadian government was asking, and they got the response. It doesn't mean we stop collecting. Now, instead of paying to my office, they will pay it through the bank," end quote. International human rights lawyers have confirmed that this is not, in fact, in compliance with the Canadian government's request, and what the final resolution will be remains to be seen.
And now some environmental news about our neighbors across the border. Experiencing the nation's most widespread drought in decades, more than half of the continental United States is currently in some stage of drought, and the majority of the remaining is enduring some abnormally dry conditions. Hardest hit areas are central and midwestern corn and maize farmers. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization lowered their expected maize yields by 25 million tons, and the U.S. government have reduced their forecast for drought-hit corn production by 17%. They are not the only victims, however, as the impact of this natural disaster can be felt throughout levels of society. The U.S. is the world's biggest producer of corn, soybeans, and wheat in the world, so this year's poor harvest has sent prices of these commodities skyrocketing. In Chicago, the price of corn experienced a 60% increase in prices over the last 2 months. Some are saying that there are external powers at work, however. We are vulnerable because even in a good year, global grain production is barely sufficient to meet growing demand for food, feed, and fuel. This in a world where there are 80 million extra mouths to be fed every year. This is a, end quote. This is from a statement, joint statement by three UN officials, including UN Food and Agricultural Organization Director General Jose Graziano da Silva on Tuesday, on September 4th. The three went on to identify the issue as a global one, a problem that can't be solved by panic buying and imposing trade restrictions by individual countries, but rather requires, quote, swift and coordinated, end quote, international effort. In the short run, Da Silva suggests a temporary halt in U.S. government-backed production of ethanol from corn, channeling the corn towards food and feed purposes.
And those are your provincial and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your weekly health segment.
Yes.
That's it.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the commercial drive area at
Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. It is now time for our weekly science segment, not health, by Simply Science by Sarah Chow.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. As a kid, someone told me that if I pinched my cheeks, I could get a natural blush going. Although it kind of hurt, it did the trick. Eventually, the blood would run out and return my face unblushed. But for some, particularly women between the ages of 30 to 50, fair-skinned, and those who have a weak immune system, perpetual blushing is part of their everyday lives. Rosacea is a common skin disorder that affects 3% of the population. In fact, some people have it and don't even know they do. Rosacea causes the skin to become inflamed and red. It's mostly seen on the cheeks, nose, and chin. In some severe cases, skin lesions can form and lead to disfigurement. Many people who suffer from rosacea avoid going out in public and have lowered self-esteem and self-confidence because they just can't hide from it. Scientists don't know why some people develop it and why some don't. They aren't even really sure what causes it. All they know is that it gets worse with age and skin damage, like sun exposure. Currently, there is no cure, only ways to control it. But a study published in New Scientist may have found the cause and a way to treat it. But it may leave sufferers wishing they were left in the dark, especially acarophobics, those who suffer from the fear of mites and other bugs that cause itching. Because researchers at the National University of Ireland have found that rosacea is triggered by bacteria living on our skin. So where do we get this bacteria from? You won't believe it. The bacteria comes from tiny worm-like mites called Demodex folliculorum, who make their home in the hair follicles on our faces. But that's not the gross part. The bacteria that causes rosacea only gets released when they die. You see, these mites can't actually poop, so they basically live a life in constant constipation. When they die, the mites disintegrate, and that's when all the bacteria emerges from their digestive tract. So that's like days of poop all over your face. And that's what triggers an immune response from the skin on your face. And that's why it gets all red. Now, it could be possible that rosacea sufferers are fighting the bacteria from the poop harder than others, because everyone has these mites on their faces. And that's why they display the characteristic redness. But scientists aren't too sure. But on the bright side, researchers know doxycycline, an antibiotic well known to combating this bacteria, has been effective in treating rosacea. See? A bright side. Now, my next piece of news also involves bugs, but it's also about saving tomatoes. Tomatoes have been long-term cultivated to having a beautiful, bright red skin, to be round, plump, and oh, so juicy. But beauty isn't everything. You see, long-term cultivation has led tomato crops to lose a beneficial trait their wild counterparts have, and that's fighting off insects, naturally. Tomato plants have things called trichomes. They're those prickly, hair-like things on the branches of tomato plants. Trichomes produce specialized compounds to ward off pests. One of these specialized compounds is called acyl sugars, which is basically a chain of sugars. No one really knows how they attach to each other, until now. Researchers at the Michigan State University have found an enzyme called S1AT2 that helps link these protective sugars together. Domestic tomato plants aren't bred to produce high amounts of acyl sugars. In fact, they lack it. But now they know which enzyme links these sugars together, so researchers can help reintroduce these protective sugars back into domesticated tomatoes so they can fight off pests all by themselves. Hoo-yah! Hoo-yah! Hoo-wah! Don't you just hate it when you have a cold and your nose gets all stuffed up and you can't smell a thing or even taste anything? Well, you're lucky it's not permanent, because for some, the lack of smelling, or anosmia, is part of their everyday lives. It's an inherited genetic disorder that has left researchers sniffing for more clues to restore one's sense of smell. But how do we smell in the first place? In our noses are cells that help us smell. These cells are special because they have tiny hair-like structures called cilia that stick out. Now, cilia are important because they contain proteins called odorant receptors. And like their name suggests, they receive odors and turn them into chemical signals the body can understand and process. Those suffering from anosmia don't have cilia. And without cilia, they don't have odorant receptors, so they can't smell. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University, in collaboration with other institutions, genetically mutated mice that destroyed their cilia, and therefore stopping them from being able to smell. They then tried to correct the mutation by infecting mice with the correct version of the cilia gene. And you knows what? It worked. Mice were able to smell again. But how can you tell if a mouse can smell? Well, researchers saw a 60% increase in body weight, which means they had an increase in appetite, which is great news for them and anosmia sufferers. That's it for this week for Simply Science for CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia. I'm Sarah Chow.
And thank you to Sarah Chow for that fantastic segment. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us on News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM.
For CITR 101.9.
The Study and Go Abroad Fair, Canada's largest international university and student travel fair, is back in town. Another great opportunity to meet face-to-face with top universities from around the world to start planning your trip abroad. Exhibitors will be showcasing programs in law, medicine, health sciences, arts, and so much more. Mark Saturday, September 22nd on your calendar and come down to the Vancouver Convention Center. Doors open at 1 p.m., but come early at noon to catch our guest speaker. Check www.studyandgoabroad.com. For more information and to pre-register online.
You've been troubled, you've been broke, you've been hungry, no job, no money. The one you love has deserted you. That makes you blue.
Got the blues? Just want to hear some blues? Tune in every Saturday afternoon from 3 to 5 for Code Blue. Right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, www.citr.ca. Code Blue.
Here's how he feels about it. Blues ain't nothing but a man, good man feeling bad. No, that's all that is.
And welcome back to News 101. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. It is now time for our international headlines brought to you by Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman.
DemocracyNow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're on the road in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm Amy Goodman. At least one person has been killed in Pakistan as protesters fill the streets across several cities in what's expected to be a massive day of action against the U.S.-made film Innocence of Muslims. The Pakistani government declared Friday a public holiday to allow people to demonstrate against the film, which mocks the Muslim prophet Muhammad. Pakistan shut down cell phone service in major cities as officials moved to block roads to U.S. diplomatic missions. In the Pakistani city of Peshawar, a driver named Muhammad Amir was shot dead by police as he drove through an area where protesters were torching a movie theater. Dozens of deaths, including that of the U.S. ambassador to Libya, have already been linked to protests and violence that has swept Muslim countries around the world as a result of the film. A French cartoon depicting Muhammad in pornographic poses has only added new fodder to the global outcry. On Thursday, thousands of Pakistanis demonstrated in the capital of Islamabad as police and security forces attempted to block access to the U.S. embassy. At least 50 people were reportedly injured as police fired live rounds and tear gas. Protests were reported in multiple other countries Thursday, including Indonesia, Iran, and Afghanistan, where hundreds of people held a peaceful march in Kabul and chanted anti-American slogans. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State William Burns held talks in Libya Thursday with the country's new prime minister and head of the National Congress following last week's attack on the U.S. embassy in Benghazi that killed the U.S. ambassador and three of his staff. Burns attended a ceremony to honor Ambassador Christopher Stevens.
This is a hard moment for all of us. It is a moment of shared loss, and it is a moment of shared hope and shared responsibility. We have lost four wonderful colleagues. We have lost a brilliant ambassador, full of courage and skill and passionate determination to help Libyans, to help all of you, to realize the promise of your revolution, to make a reality of a free Libya, of Libya al-Hura.
At least 15 people were killed and 20 wounded in Somalia after a pair of suicide bombers struck a cafe in Mogadishu. The spot was frequented by reporters and three journalists, including the news director for Somali National Television, were among the dead. In Syria, at least 54 people were reportedly killed, dozens more wounded, when government airstrikes triggered an explosion at a gas station in the northern part of the country. By some counts, nearly 200 people were killed across Syria Thursday amidst an escalating crisis between forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and rebels opposed to his regime. Meanwhile, at the United Nations Security Council, the United States and other Western countries condemned Iran for supplying weapons to the Syrian government. This is U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice.
Iran's arms exports to the murderous Assad regime in Syria are of particular concern. As a panel of experts has concluded, Syria is now the, quote, central party to illicit Iranian arms transfers, end quote. States in the region must therefore work together and redouble their efforts to deny, inspect, and seize illicit Iranian shipments, including transfers via air corridors, in line with the cargo inspection provisions of Security Council Resolution 1929.
Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has announced the last of the more than 30,000 troops that entered Afghanistan following President Obama's orders for a surge in 2009 have left the country. Panetta claimed the surge had accomplished its mission of curbing the Taliban's momentum and bolstering Afghan security forces. Nearly 70,000 U.S. troops remain in Afghanistan amidst ongoing violence there, including an uptick in so-called green-on-blue attacks by Afghan forces against foreign troops. The Pentagon has selected a former top Army commander who served in Afghanistan to oversee military operations in Africa. General David Rodriguez helped orchestrate the 2009 surge of troops in Afghanistan and also served two tours of duty in Iraq. Rodriguez still needs formal approval from the White House and confirmation from the Senate before replacing General Carter Hamm as head of Africa Command. The Obama administration's taken a number of steps to expand the U.S. military presence in Africa and ramped up the use of covert operations by the military and intelligence agencies. A Palestinian activist has agreed to end his hunger strike amid signs of progress in the global campaign for his release. Zakaria Zubaydi, a former militant-turned-activist and director of Jenin's Freedom Theater, has been imprisoned by the Palestinian Authority since May. He's been on hunger strike since September 9th. There were reports he could be released as early as Sunday. Republican Senator Scott Brown faced Democratic challenger Elizabeth Warren in the first debate of their closely watched Massachusetts Senate race Thursday. Brown began by attacking Elizabeth Warren for claiming on past documents she's Native American. Warren defended herself, saying she'd been told growing up in Oklahoma her mother was part Delaware and part Cherokee. The candidates sparred over a number of issues during the hour-long debate, including Iran, women's rights, and economic policy.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce said Professor Warren's tax policies and her approach to them are the greatest threat to free enterprise. The NFIB said her tax policies will cut 700,000 jobs, 17,000 in Massachusetts. These are independent groups who have analyzed and pointed this out. I'm going to protect the hardworking men and women, the job creators, the people who are getting up in the middle of the night and creating jobs and protecting those interests.
That was about 15 seconds. You take the same and then we're moving on.
All right.
So I think the point here is the Chamber of Commerce hasn't talked about my particular proposals. What I'm talking about here is how Scott Brown has already voted, and also talking about what he said in his own voice last week. He wanted to make crystal clear, and that is he would let taxes go up for 98% of families in order to protect tax breaks for the top 2%. I wouldn't do that.
In an appearance on the Spanish language network Univision on Thursday, President Obama faced tough questions over his immigration policies, including his failure to fulfill a campaign promise to enact comprehensive immigration reform during his first year in office. Obama called the lack of immigration reform the, quote, biggest failure of his presidency, but attempted to shift blame for the failure to Republicans.
When we talked about immigration reform in the first year, that's before the economy was on the verge of collapse. Lehman Brothers had collapsed. The stock market was collapsing. And so my first priority was making sure that we prevented us from going into a Great Depression. And I think everybody here remembers where we were 4 years ago. What I confess I did not expect, and so I'm happy to take responsibility for being naive here, is that Republicans who had previously supported comprehensive immigration reform, my opponent in 2008, who had been a champion of it, and who attended these meetings, suddenly would walk away.
President Obama's comments come as his administration faces scrutiny for deporting and detaining a record number of undocumented immigrants. Nearly 400,000 were deported during the last fiscal year. Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney also fielded questions about immigration during a Wednesday appearance on Univision. Romney attacked Obama's deferred action policy that allows some undocumented young people to remain in the country temporarily, saying a more permanent solution was needed. Romney was accused during the appearance of avoiding specific details about a possible permanent solution and asked to respond with a yes or no whether he'd deport undocumented youth.
We're not going to round up people around the country and deport them. That's not, I said during my primary campaign, time and again, we're not going to round up 12 million people. That includes the kids and the parents and have everyone deported. Our system isn't to deport people. We need to provide a long-term solution. And I've described the fact that I would be in support of a program that said that people who served in our military could be permanent residents of the United States. Unlike the president, when I'm president, I will actually do what I promised. I will put in place an immigration reform plan that solves this issue.
Mitt Romney's national campaign co-chair, Tim Pawlenty, is resigning from the campaign to lobby for Wall Street. The former Minnesota governor will head the Financial Services Roundtable, which represents J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and other financial firms. Before working for Romney's campaign, Pawlenty was considered a potential candidate for president and later as a possible vice presidential pick. An Australian public official has issued an unusually frank condemnation of U.S. Republicans. In a conference speech in Sydney on Friday, Australian Treasurer Wayne Swan cited certain segments of the Republican Party as a leading threat to the world's economy and rebuked them in stark terms.
Let's be blunt and acknowledge the biggest threat to the world's biggest economy are the cranks and crazies that have taken over a part of the Republican Party. Despite President Obama's goodwill and strong efforts, the national interest there was held hostage by the rise of the extreme Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. And there can be few things more alarming in public policy than a political movement which was genuinely prepared to see the government of the United States default on its obligations in order to score a political point.
In the Canadian province of Quebec, the new government has cancelled a tuition hike that sparked mass protests earlier this year. The new Quebec Premier, Pauline Marois, fulfilled a campaign promise less than 24 hours after the new government came to power by repealing the fee hike. Students had launched a massive strike over the increase, with hundreds of thousands taking to the streets wearing red squares. Quebec's tuition will now return to just over $2,000. And the Russian punk group Pussy Riot will be awarded the Lenin Ono Prize Award by the artist and activist Yoko Ono today in New York. Three members of Pussy Riot were sentenced last month to 2 years in prison for staging a protest against Russian leader Vladimir Putin inside an Orthodox cathedral. The husband of jailed member Nadia Tolokonnikova will accept the award today. Peter Verzilov is in the United States along with Pussy Riot's legal team in a bid to gather U.S. support for the group members' release. On Thursday, Pussy Riot received a boost from Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who's currently on her first visit to the United States in more than three decades.
I don't see why people shouldn't sing whatever it is that they want to sing. Well, there's nothing wrong with singing. I think the only reason why people should not sing is if what they're saying is deliberately insulting or if they sing terribly. I think that would be the best reason for not singing at all. So I would like the whole group to be released as soon as possible.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on the road in Madison, Wisconsin, part of our 100-city tour, and you can go to our website.
And thank you to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! You can listen to their headlines and their segments at democracynow.org. We now go to more international news brought to you by Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. In Quebec, a controversial university tuition hike has officially been canceled by the government. The planned increase led to months of mass protests in several cities and the eventual ouster of the Liberal Party. FSRN's Stephanie Clermont reports from Montreal.
As promised during her summer campaign, newly elected Quebec Prime Minister Pauline Marois says tuition rates will not change from last year's levels. She made the announcement during her first press conference Thursday afternoon. Marois was elected September 4th after months of student and social uprising led former Prime Minister Jean Charest to call elections this summer. The new government has also canceled Law 12, a series of policies restricting protest rights which were passed in response to student mobilization. Stéphanie Clermont, FSRN, Montréal.
In Pakistan, protests continued against an anti-Islam film trailer. Local media reports say between 13 and 19 people died in protests or clashes with riot police. Today's protests in Pakistan have been the most extreme in terms of deaths. And although protests continued elsewhere, like in Malaysia, Iraq, and Bangladesh, the intensity and reach of the actions seem to be waning. Part of the reason can be attributed to government responses, even at the expense of certain freedoms. That's the case in India-administered Kashmir, where authorities today acted proactively to thwart any potential violence by imposing an undeclared curfew and shutting down mobile phone and internet services. FSRN Shanawaz Khan has the details.
There was no call for protests or a shutdown, but after widespread actions Tuesday, authorities feared another outbreak Friday and imposed curfew-like restrictions in Srinagar and other towns. A holiday was declared for schools and colleges. By noon, cell phone service was not available and the internet was down. Still, police say that groups of protesters assembled at several sites. Minor clashes have been reported. The government also banned upload and download of the video and directed internet service providers to block any links to it, even if that required blocking whole domains like YouTube and Facebook. Shanawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
The president of Sri Lanka visited India today, drawing the ire of protesters who say the country committed atrocities against Tamils during the war that ended in 2009. FSRN's Shurya Niazi reports.
Sri Lankan President Mahindra Rajapaksa landed with tight security in central India, where he attended a ceremony to mark construction of a new Buddhist university in Sachi. But not everyone was pleased with his visit. Renowned Tamil leader Vaiko and more than 200 of his supporters were detained on the border of Madhya Pradesh state. They were released later in the evening. Protesters are calling on President Rajapaksa to take responsibility for alleged atrocities against thousands of Tamils in Sri Lanka. A UN panel found evidence of war crimes committed by both sides during the government's war with the Tamil Tiger rebel group. Shuranyazi, FSRN, India.
With only a few weeks remaining before schools open in Senegal, many victims of recent major floods in the capital are apprehensive about their future. Thousands who lost their homes are currently being sheltered in the schools, and there won't be room for both students and the displaced. FSRN's Alpha Jallo visited one of the schools and files this report.
Flooding over the past 2 months has devastated parts of Dakar, the only option for some has been to seek refuge in temporary shelters like schools. Now, with classes beginning, hundreds of families, including that of Jainaba Jallo, face a predicament.
If we are ordered to leave the school premises because school is about to open, I will leave. But I have no place to go with my family.
Aisto Sal shares the same primary school classroom with Jallo.
All of us who are in this school are people with families who lost everything they had to the floods. Some have lost our houses and all our other important valuables. So since school is coming to open, we want the government to repair our homes or relocate us somewhere else. If they can't do that now, let them give us money so that we can rent homes to stay with our families.
The government has still not provided an other option, but on Wednesday, Congress voted to abolish the Senate. The plan is to use the savings, about $15 million, for flood prevention efforts and to help the displaced. But the opposition, which holds a majority of the Senate seats, says the move is aimed at decreasing their power in government. Alpha Jallo, Free Speech Radio News, Dakar, Senegal.
And finally, the U.S. troop surge in Afghanistan is officially over. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says the 33,000 U.S. troops sent to the country as part of the Obama administration's surge strategy are now home. The increased three-year U.S. presence was intended to knock back insurgents, and officials have touted gains. But a recent rise in internal attacks raises questions about its ultimate success. Full troop withdrawal is scheduled to be completed by 2014. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You are listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that's our program for Friday, September 21st. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Claire Eagle. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded with your host Matt, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.